Thank you for joining us today on Vox Pop. I'm Brian Shields. We're talking automotive maintenance and repair today with Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber and Fricke Automotive Incorporated, an independent repair, auto body, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick Falls, New York. Gordon has been in the repair and service industry for more than 30 years, beginning at Factory Mechanics Training School in Wolfsburg, Germany, back in the 70s, 1979. From there, he moved on to earn an associate's degree in automotive mechanics from Hudson Valley Community College and a Bachelor of Science degree in vocational technical education at the State University of New York's College of Technology in Utica. Prior to starting his own business in Hoosick Falls, Gordon worked as an automotive technician, service advisor, and assistant service manager at a Volkswagen, Porsche, and Audi dealership. Gordon Fricke is our guest today on Vox Pop. It's all about automobiles, repair, maintenance. Today, your calls are welcome. 800-348-2551. Again, the number to call, 800-348-2551. Two open lines. Get in right now, and we'll get you on the program. Gordon, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
It is almost pothole season, if it isn't already. Now, the best thing to do, of course, is to avoid those craters. But if we don't, what can happen to the car other than a blown tire?
Well, you know, I had to steer around a bunch of them just getting here today, mainly on Hoosick Street in Troy. And they really do pose a lot of trouble to the car's wheels, tires, suspension. The immediate problem would be a flat tire. Yeah. You could get a bent wheel or a cracked wheel. So many rims today are made out of alloy or aluminum, and they're very expensive. So avoiding them is a good thing as long as you're not steering into other cars.
Yeah.
But it'll also take a toll on the shocks. And all of your steering and suspension is just eventually going to take a beating from it.
800-348-2551, the number to call. 800-348-2551. Most of us have been told that you have to change the oil every 3,000 miles. I've also heard every 5,000 miles if you've had the car a while. When do we change our oil?
Yeah, extremely good question. And we get a lot of calls regarding oil, oil quality. What is synthetic oil? How often do you change it? For a long time, that 3,000-mile interval was a very good catch-all for everything. Oils started to improve. Car manufacturers were building a bit tighter tolerances, and they felt that their oil change intervals could be extended. And you started seeing 5,000, 7,500, 10,000. Some cars are 15,000 miles. That's all great in the car's early years, but sludge and particles accumulate, and they build up inside the engine, and then they start to clog little teeny passages. And we're seeing a lot of cars today with what's called variable valve timing. And that's a real fancy term, but the engine is capable now of doing some changes regarding how the engine valves operate. And they're doing that by the pressurized engine oil. And when this dirty oil that hasn't been changed often enough starts to plug up these mechanisms, you have problems with the engine. And it's premature wear on some of those components, very poor running conditions, check engine lights coming on, and very expensive repairs. So my recommendation is, unless you're in a perfect climate, which we are not here, and you're not on a perfect commute, you really should take those manufacturer's intervals and at least cut them in half. And in some cases, if you're doing a lot of around-town driving, a lot of stop-and-go, a lot of idling, go to that 3,000-mile interval. And it's only going to help you in the long run with your life, with the engine's life of your car.
800-348-2551. Let's talk to John in Clifton Park. John.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
I got a problem with a 2013 Dodge Dart. It's my wife's car. 6 months old. It's got 2,600 miles on it. The battery light comes on. And you take it to the dealer. He checks everything. Can't figure out what's wrong with it. He tells us you're not driving it enough. She drives it a half hour each way to work every day, Monday through Friday. And I look online. I see there's all kinds of problems with computer stuff and battery lights. And what do you think about him saying that you're not driving the car enough?
Well, what they're telling you is true on a vehicle that really is not driven much. But a car like this is being driven every day to and from work. I don't think that's going to apply here at all. If this car sat for a week at a time, and when it did get driven, it was 2 minutes to the store and 2 minutes home, and then it was shut off again for another few days, I would maybe believe that, because what's happening there is the vehicle's charging system or the alternator is not able to keep the battery up to the proper charge because it's just not running enough. In your case, with this car under normal use, a regular commute, did you say it goes a half hour each way to work?
Yep.
Yeah, that's a great commute, really, because everything's warmed up. You've been on the road long enough. The battery light is a little deceiving of a term. It really should be called the charge indicator light, because a lot of people think, oh, my battery's bad because my battery light came on. But that's an indication of the charging system, and it's watching the vehicle's voltage. Today's cars, your Dodge Dart in particular, the charging system's under the control of the computer. So there's not the traditional voltage regulator and all the things that cars used to have that could go wrong. And Dodge was one of the first car makers to start looking at battery temperature. They have a little sensor at the bottom of the battery. And I'm not sure if the Dart has that, but a lot of Dodge vehicles do. So they take into consideration the temperature of the battery and they adjust the charging volts accordingly. Make a long story short, it is an issue that needs to be remedied. And I have a feeling that they're not going to be able to put their finger on the problem till the battery light stays on while they do the testing. And or if they gather enough other Dodge Darts doing this, the factory will have a fix that they'll know internally.
Yeah, it's been going on for a while, and there's a lot of people online that have the problem, and then the battery goes dead, and they have other problems. One guy had his whole cluster replaced. You look online, it's like a nightmare.
Yeah, if the battery light is telling you the truth when it's on, that means that the charging system is not doing its job, and the end result definitely could be a dead battery, and you could be stranded.
Yeah. Well, they have no fix for it, so the fix is drive the car more.
Oh, boy.
Well, thank you for calling, John.
Okay, thank you.
800-348-2551, Gordon Fricke, Automotive Repair and Maintenance, today on Vox Pop. Norbert in New Jersey. Hello, Norbert.
Yeah, hi. I have a 1990 Honda Accord, and during the winter time, cold temperatures, when I go to shift, especially into reverse from stopping, it takes a while for it to kick into gear, whereas opposed to when it's summertime and warm temperatures, it goes right in normal. Have any idea about that?
Sure. Now, this is an automatic, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So you're just noticing in the wintertime a much longer delay from the time you put it in reverse to the time you feel it engage and you can start moving?
Right.
How is it after you're fully warmed up and have been driving a car during the day?
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't. So it's a long delay no matter what.
Right.
But warm weather, it's not such an issue?
No, there was no issue in the warm weather.
And does it do this every winter?
Whenever the weather's cold, yeah.
Okay, all right.
The last couple of years, actually.
All right, yeah. I just wanted to make sure this wasn't just happening within the last 3 weeks or months since we've had a lot of cold weather. The automatic that Honda uses in your car, it's called Honda-matic, and it's a little different than normal automatic transmissions, whereas you can't really take a pan down and look in the transmission and check for particles and clean a screen or a filter. So the only maintenance for these is a drain and refill.
Oh, I have that done on a regular, according to the book. I have all that stuff done.
A lot of miles on the car?
2003, I think. 200,003.
Okay.
And the thing runs beautiful.
Yep.
I love the car.
Well, because of the age and the mileage, yeah. If the delay is not too terribly long, I would recommend just living with it because the repair is going to be a big deal.
Right.
And the general rule is from shifting from park or neutral into a drive gear, reverse or drive, if you can count 3 seconds, one 1,000, two 1,000, three 1,000, and you're still not engaged, it's getting a little bit on the long side. But there are a lot. You want to allow 3 full seconds. Okay. Sounds like a really quick period of time, but when you're sitting in traffic, it isn't.
Yeah, that's the main issue. If I go to do any kind of parallel parking, you know, it's everybody's blowing their horn.
Yeah.
Or nuts,
so. There isn't anything you can do really on the outside to solve that. So I think you just need to live with it.
Okay, I have one other question. We have a 2006 Tundra, and we also had a 2000 Tundra. They had to replace the frame on it. And my son was wondering if there's any kind of protective coating that we can put on that to keep that frame from, you know, starting to rust also.
Well, I don't know this for a fact, but I would think that Toyota really did a good job on these replacement frames so this doesn't happen again. Mm-hmm. There are coatings that can be applied, and there are some that are made to apply to underbody or exterior pieces like your frame that don't fully harden up like paint, where it'll flake and chip off.
Okay,
And the way to seek this stuff out is to maybe try to find a outfit that still does undercoating or rust proofing. There's a few still left.
Right.
And just see what they have to say about it.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Gordon Fricke, our guest on Vox Pop at 800-348-2551. Gordon, I've had standards and I've had automatics. It always seemed the standard brought more problems with it. Is that usually the case or just my bad luck?
Well, that's a good question, because automatics will eventually fail in some fashion, mm-hmm. because of all the things that have to happen inside there to get the car moving, initiate all these automatic shifts up and down. Some automatics have gotten incredibly good and they will last a couple hundred thousand miles or better. Others much less than that, and they're so expensive now to repair. Manuals, pretty straightforward, a lot of gears, a lot of metal, for the most part, don't create a lot of trouble. But you do have a clutch issue.
Yeah.
And the clutch issue can be pretty expensive in itself nowadays. So if you have to encounter a clutch replacement on a modern-day car with a flywheel that's now called a dual-mass flywheel, and that has to be replaced, you could be into several thousand dollars for a clutch. So it used to be everybody thought the manual or the standard shifts were less expensive to live with down the road, but I don't know.
Yeah. 800-348-2551, all the way to Burlington. Joe, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to preface my question. I drive a 93 Ford Festiva and also a 1971 Volkswagen Campmobile, so that's my base of reference. However, the other week I was asked to assist someone who had a vehicle that was 3 years old and needed some help in working on their brakes. And while assisting him, I was surprised that looking at the suspension and exhaust and brake components, rotors, and calipers, the rust that I saw on the vehicle. So anyway, I decided to go online and see if there's any reason why I saw what I thought was a relatively new car who had such corrosion on it. And I learned that there's a school of thought that the use of this road brine is impacting the underbodies and also the vehicle fit and finish. And it was interesting that Europe appears to, Volkswagen appears to have had a spike in the incidence of those problems in the last couple of years. And I further learned, though I'm not an expert on road brine, that Europe has used road brine before New York State, and New York State has used road brine before Vermont. So I thought, well, I can pick your brain to see if there's anything that you have noticed or that you can associate with the use of road brine, and I can anticipate as something that I should look for when I'm poking around underneath the vehicle and doing some repair work. And in addition, you touched upon some type of surface preparation or prevention techniques that might be used. But is there some type of rattle cam product or something that you have an experience with or know about that would be useful to somebody who's a garage tree mechanic.
Yeah, that's a good question, because in the Northeast or any snow area that uses salt on the roads, it's very frustrating for us to work on these vehicles because they are so rusty in so few years. And on the outside, the vehicles look fine. But when you raise them up on a lift to have to do brake work, suspension work, steering, some of these vehicles are so rusty, it's just incredible. And you're right, it's the salt, it's the brine that gets everywhere when you're traveling on wet roads after snowstorms. And to effectively wash that away every snowstorm would be almost impossible, unless you could raise the car up in your garage and completely hose the bottom down, which nobody can do that. As for products that can go on and kind of coat everything, I don't know what's available in a rattle can type thing where you can shake it up and apply it to your own car, because it's very difficult to get it in every nook and cranny and everywhere that it needs to be. All the fittings that connect the brake and fuel lines together. A lot of the cars have gotten much better against rust due to the use of stainless steel lines, plastic lines, epoxy-coated lines. But there are still some products out there that can be applied, although there's not a lot of them. And I would just there was a caller before you that talked about a similar subject. And I think the thing to do is to search out and see if there are any of these rust-proofing outfits still left and what they're using nowadays. The products have improved. They don't flake off and harden up and fall off. They stay gooey and flexible.
Yeah, so does the road brine. If you look at the chemical composition of the road brine, there's all these proprietary formulations that various regions, I'm not even sure whether New York State uses the same type of road brine that Vermont does, for example. But the anecdotal stories that I've heard from other people interested in the subject is that this road brine has such a tacky quality to it that it basically adheres to all the surfaces with very strong difficulty, or its difficulty to clear off because of that tackiness that the brine has,
yeah,
versus the traditional rock salt.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that is contributing to way more rust than we are accustomed to.
Joe,
I don't know what the answer is.
Joe, we're going to let you go and move on now to John and Troy. John.
Hi. I have two questions. The first one's a quickie. I think my air injection pump is not running. I've got two codes that have been thrown, and I assume it won't pass inspection, but I'm wondering if I'm doing any damage by not repairing that quickly.
Sure, John. What kind of car is it?
It's a 2010 Audi A4.
Have you previously heard a little air pump running?
I never noticed.
Okay,
frankly.
Yeah, they're pretty quiet nowadays.
Yep.
In the earlier years, when you started the engine up cold, you heard an electric fan come on for 1 to 2 minutes after a cold start, and then sometimes it would come back on one or two times.
Yep.
And it was pretty audible. You at first people would say, "What's that noise?" And then if that pump were to start wearing, it would get louder and louder. And in the Audis of the 2000 vintage, 2000 to 2005 maybe or 6, they made a lot of noise before they failed. To answer your question, for a New York State inspection, if the check engine light is on, it will not pass.
Right.
And if this air injection pump is not running, that could be the cause of it. Are they air injection codes, secondary air codes?
Yeah, two secondary air codes, and when I cleared them and started the car, they came right back on.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm thinking it's either the motor's not running or that valve is not working.
Yeah, it is possible.
Is there any damage that would do?
Not really.
Ignore that for a little while?
No, not really. It, you know, the system is going to is going to try to turn itself on. The computer's going to try to command those components on, even though they may be not functioning. you could, there is a big fuse that goes to that air injection pump.
Right, I think it's in the ECU compartment, though, right?
It's not out where all your normal fuses are, correct.
Yeah.
And, of course, if that fuse is blown, the reason is why, and it's a very heavy fuse.
Right.
But if we've, a lot of times we'll find that big fuse blown, and we'll put a new one in it to see what happens, and that pump might run again for a couple of tries but draw so much current that it blows the fuse again. I wouldn't assume that the pump is bad. It really needs to be tested.
Yeah, and no, being I will do that. It's just
you're probably still under warranty, though, aren't you? How many miles are on that car?
No, I'm just out.
Too many miles?
41.
Check your coverage, because a lot of those emission components might go over and above the standard.
Yeah, my understanding of it, a lot of emission components aren't, but that the air but that the air injection pump is not one of them.
Okay.
But I will check that.
Very good.
The other question that I had was just. I'm thinking about buying a new car with one of these clean diesels, and I've heard from folks in Europe that have had, you know, a lot more diesels than we have here, that the newer diesels are not really the sort of the same reliability and such that, you know, have led to there being so many diesel engines over there. I was just curious if you've had any experience yet with these newer diesels, and also whether a short commute or living here in the Northeast would have any impact on a decision of whether to buy one.
Yeah. The latest clean diesels from Volkswagen and Audi, performance-wise, startability, economy, they're fantastic. They don't even sound like a diesel.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
They've gotten quieter. More efficient, easier to start. They're direct injected now. There is no diesel pump anymore like there used to be. It's totally electronic. So the vehicle operates similar to a gas engine as far as the injectors are being controlled by a computer now. So it's not your basic full mechanical diesel engine, which none of them are anymore.
Right.
So there is a lot of new technology in there. My experience with them has been quite good, although I don't have lots of them in the area that I work on. But the people that have them are very happy with them because the economy is great and the performance is beautiful.
Right.
So
yeah. Everything sounds good about them, except I've heard that where they've been around for a little longer, they're having some reliability issues.
Yeah, the issues that I'm seeing with them are the electronics in terms of the emissions. It has a catalytic converter, it has a particulate filter, and it has oxygen sensors. And because the diesel is a dirtier exhaust, you're seeing problems with those systems sooner than you would with a gas engine, and they're very expensive. So, yeah, you're right on track. What you've researched is true.
Thank you for calling, John.
Yeah, appreciate your help. Thank you.
Thank you. Fox Pop on WAMC, Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated, which is in Hoosick Falls, New York. We're taking your calls about car repair and maintenance. And next in line is Ernie in Troy. Ernie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 2004 Honda Accord. It's got 185,000 miles on it. And for the last 6 months or so, I've had this issue where when I get up to speed, like on a highway, and I reach somewhere between like 35 and 50 miles an hour, if I maintain the speed, either with the cruise control or with my foot on the gas, the car will start to shudder. It's not a violent shudder, but you do feel it. Like I'm not feeling it just in the steering wheel. I feel it sort of like throughout the car. The tachometer is, you know, somewhere around 1500 RPMs. If I step on the gas, it goes away. If I step on the brake, it goes away. So I was just wondering if that sounds like something you're familiar with.
So is it consistent? Every day you drive it, it'll do it right at that point?
Yes.
Okay. So if you let off on the gas, as soon as it occurs, it stops?
Right, once the speed comes down,
Okay, so it has to be at that speed. So if, what is the speed again where it's happening?
It depends, you know, it varies anywhere between like 35 and 50 miles an hour. If I'm going 65, it doesn't do it.
Okay.
And if I'm going around, you know, through the city at 30, it doesn't do it.
So let's say you're at 50 and it's doing it. If you were to put that in neutral, would it continue to shudder? Have you tried that?
That's a great question. My gut tells me no, but I'll definitely have to try that.
Okay. What you probably have happening, and you're saying it's not shaking the steering wheel, you're feeling it in the whole car?
Right. You feel it like almost like in your ears and everything.
Yep. You've either got an issue with a rear wheel or a tire out of balance, or this tire could be slightly going out of round, and that's why it's affecting the whole car and not just jiggling the wheel. However, if that shake stops the second you put it in neutral, then you've got a driveline issue, a CV axle, a CV joint, something to do with the drive of the car. So do that experiment. And if you find that the problem doesn't change one bit, whether you're in neutral or in gear, then it's a rotational problem with one of your wheels or tires more than likely. But if it stops the second you put it in neutral and you don't feel it again, it's in the driveline. It's probably a CV axle.
Okay, great. Great. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. We're talking to Gordon Fricke today. It's all about cars on Vox Pop and Gene in New Jersey. Gene?
Hello. Thank you for taking my
sure.
call. My 17-year-old son is looking for a car, and we found a 2000 Mitsubishi Eclipse that has 131,000 miles on it. But they don't know if the timing belt has been changed. I'm wondering if you would recommend that if we do purchase this car, that we have the timing belt changed immediately.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And we run into this a lot with purchases where the timing belt's unknown. 130,000 miles, you said?
Yes.
Yeah. If it has not been changed, it's on severe borrowed time.
Right.
If it has been changed, you don't know when, you don't know what to do with it. What do you have a shop where you normally take your vehicles?
Yes, we do.
Okay. What I would do is ask them to get a look at that belt. Take the cover, take the easiest cover off and look down in there and see what kind of shape the belt is in.
Okay.
And what we'll generally do in a case like that is turn the engine over, bump the engine around so we can see the whole belt make a complete revolution without starting the engine, and then we're looking for the manufacturer's printing on the belt. And if it comes around and that label looks perfect, then there's a chance that that belt is not very old. But if the belt looks horrible and everything's kind of worn off the back side of it and you can't read who made the belt, you really should have the whole job done. Because if it does break, or any component that timing belt runs around, a water pump or any of the pulleys, any of those things, if they fail, can do serious damage to the engine.
Right.
And there's
right.
no warning usually. You know, you might, if you're lucky, you might hear some squealing noises or some rattling noises, and you'll take it in, and the shop will say, "Wow, you're lucky. The water pump's ready to fall off."
Right.
But
right.
so yeah, you.
Now,
go ahead.
What does something like that cost to have replaced on the vehicle?
It varies a lot because if for example, now yours is a four-cylinder, but if it was a V6 engine, it's a bigger belt. There may be more pulleys and idler wheels in there that keep that belt in line. A lot of vehicles, the water pump is driven by the timing belt, and in that case, it wants to be changed because it's a turning part along with the belt. So 500 to 1,000 is a pretty good range for a lot of cars, and you can get into some high-end cars that are into the $1,500 range.
Right, right.
It's not cheap, but it's cheaper than an engine.
Yeah, and I heard you speaking with someone else about the a manual transmission. Is that something that we should be concerned about at 131,000 miles of the clutch?
Is this car a manual?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Brian and I were talking about that briefly earlier. For the most part, the manual transmission generally is not a big problem on most cars. The clutch is. And the clutch is a very individual component because it has to do with how the operator is using the clutch. You could give a manual shift car to the wrong person, and they could burn the clutch out in a day.
So a new driver.
Yeah. So it really depends on how
well he learns to drive.
Exactly. Yeah, and if he's going through a clutch a month, that's bad news.
Right.
But you're not going to know that.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. That's a lot of help. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. If all a 17-year-old does is burn out a clutch, I think you're pretty lucky.
You're right.
It's All About Cars today with Gordon Fricke, and Dave in North Adams is on the line. Dave?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My question is about my 2000 Toyota Corolla with an engine light. I have a friend who's an unemployed auto tech. He's got a basic analyzer. I asked him if he could check to see what kind of code it was throwing. And it turns out it's a 420 code, which from what I found out online, it could be either the front or rear oxygen sensor or the catalytic converter itself. But I guess his analyzer is unable to isolate it, but if I take it to a garage, they can isolate it down to the exact component. But he suggested that I try this stuff called Cataclean first. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. But I did. I dumped a can of that in the gas tank, and we drove the car. But what I'm wondering is, if the problem is corrected, will the engine light turn off, or does it have to be reset?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a pretty common code now. It can be an expensive one for the owner of the car. The PO420, the computer is getting information that the catalytic converter is not doing its job anymore. And the only way the computer knows that is by looking at the oxygen sensors, because they're the guys that are reporting back to the computer. And the oxygen sensor behind the converter is called the catalyst monitor. And it watches the gas coming out of the converter, compares it to what's going in, which is the first oxygen sensor. And the computer looks at those two readings, and it determines if it's working or not. So you have to have two accurate sensors so the computer makes the right decision. So whoever's doing the testing needs to watch the front sensor and watch the rear sensor. And if they mimic each other, if they cycle up and down almost exactly the same as each other, rich, lean, rich, lean, rich, lean, then it's almost always the converter's fault. But if the sensors are not working properly, you can get a PO420 and have it not be the converter. So it requires deeper testing. To answer your Cataclean question, if it is deposits and the Cataclean works and that stuff cleans the sensors and the converter, the light will eventually go off by itself, because the computer will keep checking on all of its sensors and all of its systems. And if that converter passes the test, and it has to pass it several times, so you might have to drive this car a week or two, depending on what type of driving you do. But if that stuff worked, the light will go out. And it does. Oh. It does sometimes work. I've used the stuff. It does work.
Oh, that's nice to know.
Yeah. So give it a try. Keep driving it and see what happens.
Thanks a lot.
Our listener Bill has emailed us about rust control. He suggests you go to a car wash, which will spray the underbelly about 2 days after the salt is last applied or the slush melts off. It helps a lot. Also, a company named Kano Lab sells rust remover. Also, Gardner, and he says he's used them for decades. Not perfect, but very helpful. Thanks a lot, Bill. 800-348-2551. The dreaded catalytic converter in West Haven, Vermont. Susan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had two catalytic converters put on yesterday, and I'm broke. I drive a 2008 Volvo Cross Country. I've got 135,000 miles. Related to that, I heard what you said about changing your oil more frequently. And about a year ago, I started putting a quart of oil between services. And I did have to go through 6 months of not knowing why the check engine light was on, and every time I went in, they told me something different. But yesterday we did put on two new catalytic converters, and I just was wondering if you had any thoughts.
thoughts on the oil consumption or the need for the converters?
So I've got two new catalytic converters in now, but I'm still putting in, I'm assuming I'm still going to have to put in a quart of oil between services. And I heard you said maybe I should change the oil more frequently.
How often do you have the oil changed?
7,500.
Okay. That's somewhat of a wide interval. And I know that's probably what Volvo has published.
Yeah.
And is yours, do you know what engine you have in your, is it an XC90?
No, it's a cross-country 70.
A 70. Okay, so that would be, it's an 08?
Yes.
Do you know if it's the five-cylinder engine?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's okay. that is a turbocharged engine.
Yeah.
In any case. And the oil definitely needs to be changed very regularly. And if Volvo says 7,500... I cut mine. I do mine. My wife has a XC90, and I do it every 5,000 miles. I don't go usually a mile over that.
Really? Okay.
And they hold a lot of oil. They hold 6 quarts plus. But
yeah.
I don't want to be having trouble at 130, 140,000 miles for reasons that I could have prevented by changing the oil more often.
Yeah. Well, my neighbor says perhaps because I was burning oil that cause the problems with the catalytic converters.
Nah, because a quart or 1 quart over seven, let's say you put that quart in after, 2,000 or 3,000 miles,
mm-hmm.
that is so gradual
mm-hmm.
that it isn't going to make any difference.
Okay.
If you're putting in a quart of oil every 100 miles, yes, that would plug everything up. But I would maybe scale down, do the oil changes a little more often, make sure you're using a good quality synthetic oil.
That's what I have been doing,
yep.
Yes.
And that's really about all you need to do, because the converters, there isn't much you can do to prevent them from eventually becoming ineffective. It's just a matter of time on most of them.
On the catalytic converter?
Yeah, so, never have to do that again, I would think.
Yeah, I know. $4,000 is a pretty big chunk of change, and fortunately I had donated to WAMC the week before, so they got their money. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
Thank you very much. 800-348-2551. Gordon, when a catalytic converter starts to go, do you get that awful rotten egg smell?
You can, yes. Yeah. You can start, although that is a byproduct of burning there's sulfur in gasoline.
Mm.
You're smelling the sulfur dioxide, but if catalytic converters start to fail, but they're still somewhat working, you will get more odor for sure. And that rotten egg smell can be part of it, yes.
And that tells you, get it looked at.
Yeah, usually.
Let's talk now to Stuart in Munson. Stuart, go ahead.
Hi. I have a 1999 Subaru Outback wagon with the standard transmission. And when it gets up to temperature, either on the highway or on a particularly hot day, even after a couple of miles, the clutch pedal starts to work itself in a little ways. I had the clutch replaced when I bought it. I noticed it was happening. I brought it into the shop. They adjusted it, but the problem keeps occurring. I was just wondering if you had any idea about why. It seems like it's a heat-related issue. It doesn't happen at all when it's maybe below 20 degrees.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
Well, I got to think back. On a 99 Outback, I believe that clutch, is that hydraulically operated? Was there any talk of that?
Yeah, it's hydraulic. It takes a DOT-3
brake
fluid.
Okay, yeah. And most clutches now are hydraulic. Subaru did have cables on their clutches a long time ago, but before this year car, there really effectively is no adjustment. The hydraulic clutch takes up all of its own free play, so there's no need for any adjustment in the life of the car.
Oh, okay.
If you are getting a lower than normal pedal,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to be in hotter weather, there are two things involved in that. There's what's called the clutch master cylinder, and there's the clutch slave cylinder. The master
mm-hmm.
cylinder is what's on the other end of your foot. When you press the clutch pedal to the floor,
right.
That pushes fluid down to the next cylinder that does the work at the transmission, and that's the slave cylinder. Either one of those can be the culprit here. Usually when you get a clutch changed, usually the clutch slave gets replaced, particularly if it's inside the bell housing where all the clutch components are. But if your clutch master cylinder is original, I'd be very suspicious of it.
Oh, okay.
And that can give you that lower than normal pedal. And eventually it'll give you a pedal that goes almost all the way to the floor before you get any clutch at all. Or the pedal may not even release back up by itself.
Right. Like, so, if it gets particularly hot in the summer, I was on Mount Equinox, and after going all the way up in first, I did have trouble, you know, shifting for a while.
Yeah.
You know, roll starting it down the hill. And that
yeah.
Kind
if
of
your clutch is good, and then I'm going to be suspicious of those hydraulic cylinders.
Okay. So I should look at the master then.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mount Equinox and Mount Washington, the killer of transmissions.
Oh, yeah. And brakes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
800-348-2551. Dawson is calling from New Jersey. Dawson?
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
All right. I have a 2000 Honda Civic, and when you get up to about 50 miles an hour in overdrive, fourth gear, it's an automatic transmission. When you get up to 45 to about 52 miles per hour, if you're not pushing on the gas too hard, the thing will vibrate, and it seems like it's the torque converter or something in the transmission not fully engaging. And if you push on the gas a little bit more or let off, it stops right there.
Yeah, we had kind of a similar caller earlier, mm-hmm. Having a shutter at various speeds. Yours is a 2000 Civic?
Yep.
Okay. There is something that occurs on vehicles that really fools people sometimes, thinking that they have a transmission problem when it's really something to do with the engine. And sometimes it's as simple as spark plug wires in your case. What you used to call a tune-up. So it would be a good idea to make sure that your wires, your spark plugs, and the cap and rotor and all that on that engine are not ancient. Because you can get a misfire that gives you that shuttering only when you're in overdrive on light cruise, light throttle. And sometimes it's so subtle that it won't turn on the check engine light and it won't do it any other time. So it's probably not your transmission.
Okay.
And I say probably because I can't tell here, but I would be a little suspicious of very worn plugs and very worn secondary ignition, which is the wires and stuff. I would go there first.
Okay, well, it's got new plugs on it, and it seems like it's only something to do with, like, when it's going into, like, when the torque converter locks, like, the last step of the shifting process.
Yep.
And, okay. Yep. And then another thing, with a manual transmission, when you downshift, is it all right to give a little blip on the gas pedal to match the RPM?
Yeah, it's a good idea, because that's easier on your synchronizers, because they don't have to do the... They don't have to match the speeds up. You're helping them do that. So that's not a bad idea. It's an old truck driver's trick.
Oh, okay. Very good.
Thank you for calling. 800-348-2551. A few minutes left with Gordon Fricke. Beth, go right ahead.
Hi. I was listening to what you said about older cars. I have a 2006 Saab convertible, which I bought when it had 25,000 miles back in 2009. And now it's 80,000 miles. And I don't consider it an old car because it doesn't really have much mileage. Now, do you judge age by mileage or by years?
Well, it's a good question, because I have seen low mileage older cars that are in terrible shape, and I've seen high mileage newer cars that are in great shape. So it's not a, this formula is not, what do they call it, inversely proportional or some type of mathematical term. The mileage is not terribly relevant unless you're talking 200,000 miles on a four-year-old car. That's a lot of miles. What year is the car?
2006.
And what do you have on it for mileage?
Just 80,000.
Yeah.
And I just got a notice from my dealer to bring it in for its 80,000 miles checkup.
Yeah, that's actually a very good mileage for that age car, and that's a good durable car. So I don't think you need to be worried about anything. Yeah, I don't know if that's answering your question correctly or not.
Well, I bring it in every, like, you know, 7,000 miles, 7,500, I believe that's what they said at that time, for that car, you know, oil change.
Yeah, again, I'm emphasizing more frequent oil changes more so than I ever was, because we're seeing so many oil-related problems cropping up on engines.
Mm.
If you really love this car and you're going to keep it a lot longer, do the oil changes sooner. You do them at least every 5,000 and use synthetic oil, because that Saab has a turbocharged engine.
Oh, yes, it does have. That's right.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. Just a few minutes left on Vox Pop. Sophie in Connecticut. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. I'd like to know why my 2009 Elantra, when I back it out of the driveway, it squeaks. It doesn't squeak any other time.
Would you say it's more like does it continue to squeak?
It's like a siren, you know, like that, a short burst of that sound.
But only when you're going backwards.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Most cars have wear indicators that will make that noise, indicating you might need brakes.
I did have the front brakes replaced in November.
Mm-hmm. I would have the rears checked because
the pads and the rotors.
Yep, you may need the same thing in the rear.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dean and Rensselaer, go ahead, Dean.
I have a 1999 Mercury Mystique with a little over 89,000 miles on it. The manual says to change the timing belt at 120,000, and I was wondering if I should do that now.
Yeah.
Also the hoses.
Yeah, the owner's manual may have a little thing about time as well as mileage. Does it say anything about X number of years or X number of miles? A lot of them do, but not all. But that car is old enough to where that belt has been on there all those years that it could be showing some serious wear. So I don't think it would be a bad idea to do it now because of the age and not so much the mileage.
Right.
Yeah, I would think about doing it. It's not a bad idea. It's not cheap, but it's better than an engine job.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Time for perhaps one more call. It's Gil in Framingham. Gil?
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I have a 2000 Volvo V70 wagon. And I have 55,000 miles on it. I bought it off of someone almost 2 years ago and had 21,000. My question is, I'm wondering when I should switch over to using synthetic oil and how often.
And that was a V70?
Yes, V as in Victor, V70 wagon.
Turbocharged?
I don't think so, no. It's a 5-cylinder, I believe a 2.4.
Yeah, you could get those with turbo and without. My recommendation nowadays would be, yes, to switch it to synthetic. BMW switched everything over in 1998, and I would do that with your car.
Okay.
I think it's a good thing for it. And if it is a turbocharged engine, absolutely synthetic oil.
Okay, and one more question. I just changed the transmission fluid on, but I did not have the filter changed. Is that a problem? I just had the transmission fluid flush.
Yeah, that's fine. Those filters really are not the filter that you think they are. So you did the right thing there.
All right. Thank you very much, Gil. Thank you for calling. And we're out of time. Our apologies to Brian in Greenfield. Perhaps he can call next time Gordon comes around. I want to thank everyone who called in and apologize to those who left on the line. Brian, most namely, I'd also like to thank our guest, Gordon Fricke, for stopping by. Support for Vox Pop comes from Edward Garbosik, Certified Financial Planner, Havocan Wealth Strategies, Wilbraham, Massachusetts. Providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement, HavocanWealthStrategies.com. Woodstock School of Art, Woodstock, New York, offering classes and workshops in drawing, painting, printmaking, sculpture, and more. Tuition assistance available. All levels welcome. WoodstockSchoolOfArt.org. Turtle Tree Seed, Copaic, New York, locally grown and owned since 1997, offering biodynamic, organic, open-pollinated, and heirloom vegetable herb and flower seeds. TurtleTreeSeed.org. Thanks for joining us. Our engineer, Zach Malloy, Anonymous Sandy took our calls, and producer, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Brian Shields. The news is next, and then CapCon. Thanks for joining us.